the New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner. Greetings and welcome to the New Zealand Business Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Spain, founder at Guerrilla Technology, also a business and technology commentator featured across TV, radio, and of course, digital platforms. The New Zealand Business Podcast is your place to learn from and be inspired by the stories and insights of the leaders shaping New Zealand, be they founders of multi-billion dollar enterprises or thought leaders with inside knowledge in their field. The goal of the New Zealand Business Podcast is to help you achieve more success in business and leadership, which is very congruent with Guerrilla Technology's purpose of helping our clients succeed by leveraging technology. Today, we'll be hearing from John Fisk, a managing partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers New Zealand and chair of RITANS, the Restructuring, Insolvency and Turnaround Association of New Zealand. John shares useful insights and perspectives from his business journey and his role in helping many businesses continue after getting into trouble. This episode is made possible by Guerrilla Technology, Process Street and One Plus One Communications. Let's jump in. John Fisk, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be here.
It'd be great just to start with a little bit of your background. Two roles. You're a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers and you also lead an organization called RITANS. As an insolvency practitioner, how do you, how did you get into this and, how have you ended up where you are today? What's the background story for you?
Sure. It all starts in Gisborne, of all places. When I left school, I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be an artist or an accountant. And my parents very wisely encouraged me to go down the accounting route. And so I got a job at a local accounting firm in Gisborne doing farm accounting and studied by correspondence for my professional exams. So I didn't go through the university route. I went through the correspondence night school sort of route and got qualified. I moved down to Wellington to be with my girlfriend, who's now my wife. That was 1987, just when the share market crash had hit. Shortly after that, I was at a bit of a crossroads in terms of work that we had on, and I was asked to fill in for one of the guys in Wellington that was working on a receivership of a sign manufacturer in Porirua.
And there must have been, at that time, there must have been a fair few insolvency matters to deal with the state of the economy.
There hadn't been a sort of flourishing insolvency industry, if you could call it that, for some time, but certainly post 87 and going into the dark days of 89, 90 in New Zealand, there was a lot. Any business that seemed to have the name Corp at the end of it seemed to be going into some sort of insolvency process. It was all very new, but I was given responsibility for running the sign manufacturing company, and I found that really exciting. It was dealing with people. It was working out what jobs we would do. It was going through a sales process of the business, and then paying back creditors. And we ended up paying the first, second, and third registered secured creditors. Really, there was no looking back after that. I ended up getting a secondment to London in 1990 when they were going through their big meltdown. Had 3 years there. Worked on Polypec, which was a penny dreadful that had turned into a mega company, and all sorts of fraud in Cyprus and things like that. And then also BCCI, which again was at the time the biggest bank in the world that went into liquidation. Again, the work was fascinating, after 3 years, though, we moved back to New Zealand and have been in insolvency ever since, and doing turnaround work, advising boards, trying to keep organisations out of insolvency, having a great team around me and doing some really fascinating stuff, and got into the issues with the finance company collapses, and we had a number of those: the Strategic Finance, Lombard Finance, OPI. Jobs that were really challenging and interesting, probably the biggest challenge that I've ever faced in my career was the Pike River Mine receivership, where dealing with the sort of aftermath of 29 men dying in the mine, and incredibly tragic situation and a very difficult one to work through. And then more recently, moving on to Ross Asset Management, which is New Zealand's largest Ponzi scheme. So I've had some really interesting assignments. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have been involved in a lot of those sort of things. But there's a lot of work that I do and a lot of work that my peers do in the insolvency industry, which is trying to keep businesses out of insolvency and working with boards and with other stakeholders to try and get the best out of difficult situations.
Great. And so your current role now, you have a role at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and you're also involved with leading Ritans here. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so I lead the PwC restructuring team, that's a great role to have, something that I'm passionate about is the standards in the industry and the level of professionalism, and that's where my involvement with Ritans comes in. So the Restructuring Insolvency Turnaround Association of New Zealand was established actually back in 2015, but it grew out of the Insolvency Special Interest Group that is run by the Chartered Accountants Australia New Zealand. We have a strong association with that organisation still, but it represents 455 members and 111 accredited insolvency practitioners. So by far the majority of people that work in the sector.
Well, let's jump in and I'm keen to hear, more about what are the processes that you get involved in, what triggers a receivership, what triggers the situations where you would get involved in a business. I understand that it's not just when things have gone completely pear-shaped, but, there are situations where you get involved to maybe avoid those things happening. And then there are varying, scenarios that can happen. And, I think a pretty fair percentage of those involved in business in New Zealand will have been impacted in some way by an organisation that, I guess there's all sorts of terms that we use to talk about. They went bust, they've hit the wall, and you've probably got 100, yeah. 100 others that...
some of them not so polite.
Yeah, that people say. But there are actually a number of situations that can arise, and different ways of addressing those, and the impact on those that maybe supply to those firms or are employed by those firms can vary quite broadly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a really broad subject there, but you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, businesses take risks. And, we have a great thing called limited liability. And the reason for that is a lot of people wouldn't actually go into business if they were going to lose their shirt every time something went wrong. So, we need that to have a growing economy. But there are times when businesses take risks which result in liquidity problems. The cash flow starts to dry up, a crisis happens, and that's usually when we get involved as insolvency practitioners. It's when things either start going a little bit off the rails, the profitability's not there, the margin's being eroded, and sometimes it ends up with some sort of crisis. So ideally, we get involved as early as possible. So if directors recognise that they're getting into difficulty, the sooner they call in help, the more options there are to deal with that problem. Unfortunately, a lot of New Zealand businesses, people like to try and go it alone. And that's when even more trouble starts. And that's when more formal insolvency processes happen. So Rittan's, you know, our name says what we do. So it's restructuring and it's turnaround when we've got when we can see a business that actually needs to do something. They might need to bring in more equity. They might need to have a bit of a break with their creditors, a rescheduling of repayment or something like that. And the whole intention of that work is to get the business back on track and hopefully be a thriving business and rewarding the shareholders in the future. And, you know, that's our sort of, that's our sweet spot when it comes to working with clients when that can happen. And it's incredibly rewarding.
And probably a lot of people don't know, you know, that all of those options are available. I remember, you know, quite early on in my career, probably 25 years or so ago, working for a small company. The founder of the business, I think it's fair to say, wasn't very astute with managing the cash flow. And, you know, it certainly taught me a lot of lessons about, you know, how not to run a business.
Yes.
And, you know, the catch phrase that I remember from that particular company was, the check is in the mail.
Yes.
And I heard that many times. Now, not an excuse you can use these days, but I do recall, you know, a meeting being held with all of those who money was owed to, and a bit of a repayment plan being worked out. And this organization actually went through a sale process. I think New Zealand Post ended up owning the company. And so there were good results really for everybody involved. But I imagine if they hadn't sort of stopped and had a look and got creditors on board, then there would have been a lot more trouble, shall we say?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, often it's because business owners, they can be so engaged in the business that they don't get the opportunity to stand back and look at where they are, and they think that if they just work harder, that it'll, you know, the issues will resolve themselves. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. And, you know, so we often get involved with businesses where, you know, they just need to focus on their working capital a little bit more and actually, you know, ring the accounts receivable debtors that, you know, actually owe the business money and ask for the money, because, you know, they get too embarrassed to do that, or they'll have some problem that needs to be fixed that might cost a very small amount of money, but it would mean that the rest of the debt comes into the business. But because they're so caught up in the day-to-day running of the business, they overlook those sort of things. Or they get under stress, so they don't open the mail. And so they don't know how much money they actually owe to people. And all of those sort of things need a circuit breaker sometimes. And again, that's the sort of thing where a good professional advisor can often unlock that, or if they can't, then someone coming in independently can do that. And that's the sort of thing that we often get involved with. It's not a public process. It's very much sort of under the radar. And often, though, it's because of something being initiated by, say, the bank, who has got some sort of independence from the business and can see that things aren't going well, and so that they'll invite us in to look at that sort of thing. So,
right.
So that's sort of one end of the spectrum. And then
I'm just interested in what you've seen from the businesses that you've worked with around How long should people be waiting to get paid? I mean, we see a lot of businesses now where you pay in advance for services. It ensures the cash flow of the provider. It ensures there's, you know, there's never any chasing up. But then I see businesses on the other end of the scale where they're, you know, maybe stringing out payments 60 days, 90 days, and, you know, creating a horrible situation.
Yeah.
What do you, you know, recommend on that basis? And, if, you know, of course, yes, you know, some of those things are being done by a direct debit type situation. So, you know, in that case, the company just doesn't have that that issue of having to run around, you know, chasing invoices.
Yeah. Look, I mean, getting credit is part of doing business, and businesses need working capital to survive. So, if you don't pay your creditors for 60 days rather than 30 days, and it's cheap credit. So whilst interest rates are very low at the moment, so it's not quite so relevant, in the past, you know, if you could get away with stretching your creditors a bit longer, then, you know, that was good for your working capital.
Might not be good for your relationships within any of those parties.
And that's the balance that you have to reach. So there's a balance there, and there's almost a sort of a implicit cooperation between businesses. You know, you pay on the 20th of the following month my invoice, and I'll pay your invoices on the 20th of the following month. And then so you need to look at that, but then you also need to look at the risks that you're taking. So if I'm a if I'm going to build $1 million building for you, I'm going to be negotiating not the 20th of the following month when I finish the building. I'll be wanting progress payments as I go through, and I'll want a deposit before I start because I've got to make commitments. But usually those sort of things are negotiated ahead of time, and you know, it's important for businesses to make sure that they get those rules right at the start that suits their business, because you've got to tailor it for your cash flows and what your business is doing. Where it goes wrong, of course, is when people default on that, you know, if someone has been regularly paying you on 30 days but then goes to 90, that can cause major problems. And we've seen that, you know, you see it in the construction industry at the moment. You know, we've had the failure of Ebit Construction. We've had the failure of Arrow Construction. If you are a subcontractor working for those businesses, you could easily be 4 months out of revenue. And that's a major hit to any business. But that's the sort of thing that can go wrong, because in the construction industry, you put your claim in at the end of the month, and then it usually takes another month before it's paid. And with something like Ebert, there was probably at least 2 months of outstanding claims.
Which highlights to me that there's a real breakdown when things are operating like that. You know, we've got great technology now. These things should be able to, you know, move much, much quicker, right? We shouldn't have to be in a position where that's just the norm. And I think if you look at certain industries, you know, manufacturing, construction, you know, there are probably a few that you could look at and say, well, those are the areas where bills don't get paid very quickly.
Yeah.
I've also, you know, probably seen it with, you know, bigger multinationals where there's lots of layers to go through, and you know, things seem to get forgotten. But you know, it can have a huge impact on a small business.
Oh, can.
And if you know, if you're relying on these huge wait times, you've got to have a whole lot more funding to be able to operate than you would otherwise if a bill was paid you know, at the point of it being invoiced, if it was able to be paid immediately.
That's right. And so that actually comes back to one of our enduring problems in New Zealand with small business, is that they're often terribly undercapitalized. So, you know, a man in a van can set up business really quickly. So you can become a a tradie to a big construction company, but you have to recognise that the cash flows can be lumpy, and that's just the reality of what you're working in. And they become really lumpy when the quality of the work isn't up to standard, or if there's some other factors impacting on those businesses. So as well as having good credit terms that sort of meet your cash flow, you've also got to have that buffer, which is really the equity that you put into the business to withstand some of those shocks. And unfortunately, a lot of businesses just don't have it. And the only equity effectively is probably a cross guarantee to your personal home. And, you know, that's at risk of being lost if your business fails, because that's the only security the bank will be holding.
Mm. Okay, so there's that situation where you get involved before there's a major catastrophe. Things might not be going too well. What do you apply in those situations? What are some examples of what tends to happen?
Well, every situation is different, and that's why actually it's an incredibly rewarding job being an insolvency practitioner, because we are exposed to many, many different types of businesses, but all business is all about essentially putting a dollar in and getting $2 out. So, you know, there's fundamental commercial principles that you can apply to lots of different situations, and you know, what we will often do is spend time getting to understand the business, understand where the business is making money, where it's viable, and where it's losing money. And that the nature of restructuring could be anything from, as we've talked about, you know, just rescheduling some debts and getting back on track, or it could be effectively cutting off some of the dead tissue that you know, really shouldn't be there, and stopping doing things. And often that's very hard for businesses or business owners to see when they're actually working day to day in their business. They, you know, that something that was successful yesterday is not guaranteed to be successful tomorrow.
And there can be that emotional connection as a business owner to, you know, aspects of your business, people you've employed, and so on. And a lot of that is very, very good.
Yes.
But there are times where you know, major changes have to be made in order for the business to remain viable for, you know, the rest of the parties involved. Right?
Well, you know, and if you were a video shop owner, you know, at some stage in the last, you know, 15 years probably, you should have recognised that that's not got a long way to run, and so you have to change. So, you know, people that can stand back from their business and see where things are heading, or at least are willing to change, are the ones that will survive. If you just keep coming to work and doing the same thing day after day, then you'll end up in working with me.
I agree. You know, I think we're in a time where there is so much change that, you know, every business needs to be, you know, agile and looking at what's going on continually. You know, I guess I encourage this sort of thinking of that we all need to be futurists. We all need, yes, to be, you know, putting on that hat that looks way out into the future, and a bit closer to now as well, and be working out what are the changes that we need to make. Because a business that does whatever it does today is unlikely to be doing exactly the same thing in 5 or 10 years' time, and quite possibly, you know, needs to be making changes, you know, this minute, this week, this month, this year, you know, in order to be, you know, doing reasonably well or exceptionally well, or, you know, wherever they choose to you know, want to be.
Absolutely. I mean, that's that sort of Moore's Law sort of concept, isn't it? And, you know, a lot of businesses just don't face up to that, but you're right, and the pace of change is changing, and you know, there's some fantastic tools that you can use to assist you with, you know, with changing your business, but you have to be open to them, and unfortunately a lot of businesses just don't address those issues quickly enough.
And that can be, you know, both businesses that have been around for a long time and you know, newer, younger businesses too, right? There's not you know, exactly a cookie cutter of the businesses that fail, I would imagine.
Not at all, no. And there's a myriad of issues that we face. And they're not all just in the business either. So, you know, what's happening in your personal life can have a major impact on how your business performs. And, you know, we've been involved in lots of situations where there's been marital breakups, or there's been drug problems or alcohol problems, and, you know, all those sort of things impact on the way a business operates as well. How, and also, you know, what might have been a very successful business when it was small doesn't necessarily translate to being a good business when it gets bigger, and bigger is not necessarily best. And a lot of the problems we see is when a business has been successful and then they use debt to expand, and they get to a stage where actually the owner actually doesn't cope with the business as well as they should be able to. And, you know, we've seen it in farming where you know, the number of dairy farms that are, you know, mum and dad around the kitchen table used to run, have, you know, they've expanded to owning five different dairy farms. Suddenly they now need to be a manager of a whole range of people. They're responsible for the health and safety of those people. They're responsible for large herds that they can't possibly get around and see every day like they did on their home farm. All those things can lead to massive problems, and when you've got debt,
very different skill sets.
Debt doesn't sleep. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that need for, you know, continual education, continual learning, you know, either bringing in different people with different skills, or you know, really recognizing that the role of leading that business of, you know, say five farms is very different from running an individual one.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that I see successful businesses doing is having good mentors, so that owners can actually test some of those things before getting into them. You know, again, you know, a number of the directors we meet have gone it alone, because again, it's a bit of that Kiwi attitude of, you know, I'm showing weakness to ask for assistance, but that can be absolutely fatal to the business.
Mm. And debt, any sort of, you know, guidance on you know, borrowing and financing?
Well,
growing business.
Debt can again be your friend, and it can be your enemy. You know, unfortunately, sometimes greed is the thing that actually causes the problem, because you end up with too much debt. So, you know, I completely support the idea of leveraging a business, because it can result in better returns. But you have to be able to again meet the obligations that you're taking on when you take on debt, and you need to recognise what the consequences can be if you don't pay it back. And you know, when things start getting difficult, that's when, you know, debt can be you know, a real enemy for you.
Okay, so moving on from, you know, those who would engage with you in advance and the, you know, things to be you know, thinking about with a growing business, or, you know, business that's struggling, what are the other scenarios that you know, businesses reach in terms of, you know, we hear about businesses in receivership, liquidation. What are those different states that a business can get into? How are they triggered, and how do they get that help?
There is confusion about some of those titles in terms of what is happening when a business goes bust. You know, is it in liquidation, is it in receivership, is it in voluntary administration? There's a sort of, I like to think of it in terms of a demise curve. If you think about a curve that's going downwards, and you think about that in terms of insolvency, there's degrees of insolvency that a business will go into, and the curve gets steeper as you go down it, because there's less time and options available as you go down that curve. The stuff that we've been talking about, you'd say, is sort of, you know, when a business is is having some cash flow difficulties, but you know it's still essentially viable. If you go to the next stage, it's cash flow difficulties where you actually can't meet your debts as they fall due, and recognizing when that happens is the point of where you're getting into insolvency. So the first sort of options that you've got when you're getting into that sort of situation is either a formal process, which is process like voluntary administration. So voluntary administration is effectively putting a moratorium on all the creditors when a resolution is passed by the company to go into voluntary administration. An administrator is appointed. They look at the company. They have a look at whether the company can be restructured, and they will have a vote of creditors to look at whether a deed of company arrangement or a DOCA can be entered into. That deed of company arrangement is really the blueprint for getting out of insolvency and putting the company back on track. And if you can't agree a DOCA, then the company usually goes into liquidation. So that there's actually three options that come that result from a voluntary administrator being appointed. You either hand the company back to the directors because everything's okay. After the moratorium, it's basically it's okay. You go through a restructuring, which has to be voted on by the creditors, or you go into liquidation because the creditors don't like the plan.
Right, yeah.
So that's one option. The other option is a compromise. And compromise can be either done formally under the Companies Act or informally with creditors. So if you've got, say, five creditors and you bring them all together and you say, look, if you all take a 20% haircut, we can keep going here. You write off the 20% and everything will be okay, and everyone agrees and they go on. Or you can do it more formally where you need a vote, 50% in number and 75% in value, that vote in favour of the compromise. And so the ones that don't vote for it are effectively forced into it. So you can't have the sort of outlier scuppering the plans for everyone else. But again, that's quite it's a positive process, which hopefully gets a better return than going into liquidation straight away. So all those sort of things maintain, you know, the business as a going concern, hopefully, whilst a plan is worked out, and then you get back on track. So as you continue down the sort of demise curve, as it were, I suppose that really the next process is usually receivership. And a receivership usually happens because a major stakeholder, which is often a bank, but it can be another financier, or it actually could be even a related party, has taken security over the business. Usually it's a general security agreement, and if there's an event of default, that means, you know, for example, you can't pay your monthly installments that you're supposed to under the debt, or there's been a major financial change in the business, if it's insolvent, that sort of thing, then that gives the right of the GSA holder to appoint a receiver. And the job of a receiver is essentially to get the money back for the GSA holder and then retire. And when they retire, if there is anything left of the business, it can be handed back to the directors who deal with the unsecured creditors, or it goes into liquidation. And often it can actually be both. So you can actually have a liquidation going at the same time as a receivership. But the receiver's job is essentially to get the money back for the party that appointed them, and there's a range of priorities for creditors to get paid in that situation. So you'll often see a receiver trading the business on because it might be a good business that's just overburdened with debt, and usually the method of paying back the GSA holder is through a sale. It's very seldom that you would trade the business, make enough profit to pay the debt back, and then hand the company back. Normally the whole business has to be sold, and that's what you'll often see, you know, receivership sales happening. And then the sort of the end of the road for a company is usually liquidation. And in a liquidation, essentially, you might actually trade the business for a short period of time, but the whole process is really to realise the assets, sell them collect the cash in and pay the creditors back in the order of priority. And the order of priority is essentially the secured creditor, if they've got specific security over assets, the employees, and then revenue for their preferential claims, and we can talk about that a bit more as well in terms of how that works, and then the unsecured creditors get paid. And if there's anything left at the very end of that process, then the shareholders get some money back as well.
Right. So looking at it from that perspective of somebody who's inside of, you know, maybe owns a business that's in trouble, at what point should they be taking varying actions themselves to avoid getting into a state where their business is liquidated and they've got nothing out?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's got to be coming down to knowing your business, knowing well your financials and your state, and then plugging into two experts and advisors as early on as possible if you don't already have people in those roles that are able to help.
That's right. And look, I mean, it comes back to understanding your director's duties first and foremost. Mm. And, again, there's a lot of small businesses or small companies in New Zealand where directors don't actually understand their obligations. But the obligations are pretty onerous. And you only need to look at what's happened with the Mainzeal decision that came out earlier this year in terms of how expensive that can be if you get it wrong. But
And it could be money or it could be jail time or...
Well, it's not...
Or is that not the
case? Jail time, there's an element of fraud involved in it. There is provisions for fraudulent trading, essentially, which, so if it's really bad and you intentionally go out there and incur debt with the view to basically ripping off your creditors, then there can be jail time. But most of the time, there's a financial penalty. And actually... as you'll see with high-profile directors, there's a reputational penalty, which is enormous. So the first principle is understanding what your duties are, and one of the duties is not to incur debt without the reasonable prospect of being able to pay that debt. You need to actually understand, all directors need a fundamental understanding of accounting in terms of understanding what the position is with their balance sheet. And again, if you look at the Mainzeal case, that was all about balance sheet insolvency. They had assets on the balance sheet that actually weren't collectible, and so directors should have been able to recognize that and take appropriate action, because if you actually revalued that asset at what could be recovered, they were insolvent. So understanding the financial position of the company, what is the cash flow? So, we look for things. When we go into a business as a liquidator and say, have there been any breaches of the Companies Act, we'll be looking at what records were the companies keeping. So did they understand where they were day to day and in terms of their financial position? Did they keep proper books and records? And there's a penalty on directors if they don't.
Right. So the small business owners who think, well, I've got a limited liability company, I'm entirely protected. That's not the case today when you look at what the consequences are for a director who steps out of line or isn't diligent in terms of their care of the finances and the operation of that business.
That's right.
In simple terms, right?
Yeah, so it comes back to, limited liability is a great thing, but it comes with responsibility.
Yes.
And, if the law says essentially if you're going to breach that responsibility, then there's consequences for you personally. And I think, business needs to have that sort of bite for it to not become the Wild West. So, there's very good reason for it. Some of the problems can be, though, that, you know, when a business gets too far into difficulty and the directors see that they've lost everything, then they don't care so much about what is, you know, what the consequences are by keeping on going. So they'll keep going because they'll have cash flow and they'll keep taking money out of the business. And that's where, you know, there's a responsibility on people trading with that business to make proper inquiry as well about who they're trading with and stopping credit if they're not happy.
Well, there's potentially consequences there, aren't there? And, you know, currently whereby you can get paid and then that money can get clawed back to a degree. I'm not sure what the is that a scenario you've ever seen where a receiver is able to claw back money that's been paid to a supplier who maybe should have known better? I mean, those rules, I guess, you know, shocked me when I heard that that could happen in some cases.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a liquidator that has those powers, and the voidable transactions that are entered into, you know, within 2 years of the appointment of a liquidator, the whole idea of the voidable transaction regime is to create fairness for creditors. So if you were a creditor that knew what was happening and was able to take advantage of the company and get paid ahead of other creditors, then the law says there's a sort of equalisation process that the liquidator can claw back that money and put it into the pot so it's available for everyone to share equally in.
Right. So if you hear a firm's being liquidated and you have a look and think, everything they owe us is up to date, so we're okay, that might not actually be reality if some of it ends up getting clawed back.
Well, and that depends on what your knowledge was. And also whether the terms of your trade have been met. So if what you were doing was in the normal course of business in your trade and you had no knowledge of what was happening, then you know, it's up to the liquidator to prove otherwise. And that gets, you know, that leads to litigation, and there's all sorts of cases that have been through the courts on voidable transactions. It's something that's been looked at by the government, and there was an insolvency working group that I've been involved with that has been looking at, are the rules actually fair enough at the moment? Because for every person that says, well, that's not fair, I have to pay that money back, there's another group of creditors that say, well, that's not fair either because I didn't get anything. And so, you know, I should be paid fairly as well. So it's a very difficult balancing act to get to what is a fair position. And that's the problem with all insolvency, is that someone's going to lose money. When a company's insolvent, it means that there's not enough to go around. So what's a fair process to make sure that people get a fair share or pro rata share of what's left? And that's something that's often misunderstood by many businesses in New Zealand. And, you know, understanding your ability to take security yourself, when we talked before we started recording about, you know, the Personal Property Securities Act, and taking advantage of that is something that a lot of businesses should be looking at more carefully, because we see as insolvency practitioners situations where if the creditor had been a little bit more on the game, they on the ball, and that actually used some of the rights that they might have, they would have protected themselves a lot more than just being an unsecured creditor that ends up losing a lot of money.
So what's the common situation that you know, business owners, business leaders should be aware of that, you know, is commonly missed?
Well, often it relates to the supply of goods and services, where you can take a security interest in the goods, and you know, there's rules around how you register that interest on the personal property security register, which is a public register that is noticed to the world at large that you've got an interest in assets that might be at the company's premises or whatever they may be. If you know, often we see things like a confusion between ownership and possession of assets. So, for example, computer equipment could be leased for more than a year to a business. If that computer equipment isn't registered on the personal property securities register as with your interest in it, then you can lose out to a prior security holder that might have a GSA over the company, and the proceeds from that computer equipment will end up going to the GSA holder, and the assets won't come back to you as the leaseholder.
Okay. Oh, that's useful to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's something that people can get wrong.
Particularly when
the pace of business is going quickly,
and the law changes on these, you know, these things as well from time to time. You know, what you might have put in place, you know, 10, 15 years ago might not be so relevant now if you haven't.
Well, the Personal Property Securities Act's been around for a while now, but you're right. It is the sort of thing that can catch people out.
And also that aspect of changes leadership and ownership in a business. You know, one owner will look at, you know, some aspects, others will look at others. You know, varying levels of interactions, certainly with our smaller businesses, with legal advice, and so things can get missed along the way. So obviously that's one, you know, well worth thinking about. You know, if you are leasing out equipment or, you know, on a longer term than that 12-month type basis, to make sure your house is in order with,
or any sort of credit arrangement. You know, we were talking before about, you know, how long's too long for a credit arrangement. The other way you can protect yourself is by, you know, if you have some sort of security there as well. There are options that businesses need to be aware of.
Okay, now, the common sort of situations that business owners will have, or even employees, in terms of their interactions with businesses that get into trouble. We hear feedback when somebody's been appointed in an administration role over a business, and then might be, you know, building site with tradies wanting to get their tools back, and, you know, varying other scenarios. Can you walk us through how those things work? What are the constraints, and individuals need to be aware of, as well as business owners?
Sure. Yeah. Look, I think the first thing is a bit of patience and good communication are key, because the job of, let's say, a receiver being appointed to a construction company, the first priority that the receiver has is to secure the assets. It's a very practical, logistical exercise that you have to go through, particularly if there's a lot of sites. You know, if there's 13 sites throughout the country, you're going to need a team of people that are going to each of those sites, talking to the to the key foreman on the site, getting security in place. There's a lot going on, and, you know, it's important for the insolvency practitioner to sort of make some sort of statement or communication, I think, early on, so that they inform the world about what's happening, because it's not normal. It's not a normal situation. Once the assets are secured, then it's a case of assessing, you know, what contracts can be completed, what contracts need to be handed over, and all that sort of thing. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of gathering up information, making an assessment of it, recognising the legal position in terms of what different parties' rights are, understanding where things like retentions are, dealing with the staff in terms of what's, you know, happened to them, and having staff meetings, and then getting them around the table to work out what needs to be done. So there's a lot going on. And one of the things that we were criticised of in the Mainzeal and Ebert situations was not letting subcontractors come in and take their tools and equipment back.
Because they need to get on and get working somewhere else, I suppose.
Well, they might do. So, and that's there's a couple of issues there. One is, first of all, if we left the sites open, then we could have chaos, because you could get lots of different creditors coming in trying to take assets, and they might be assets that don't belong to them. And then we'd be accused of, you know, losing assets and having them stolen, and so we need to have order on the site, and we also need to be very conscious of health and safety as well, because, you know, someone dismantling a crane without a proper process is going to cause potentially a lot of damage. So there's a reason to ensure that we have an orderly process where subcontractors can come onto site and identify the assets that belong to them and take them away, but we can't do it all at once. And so sometimes the delays might have only been a few hours or a day, and sometimes more complicated stuff, like if you're dealing with scaffolding or cranes and things like that, then it, you know, might need a few days to actually organise taking those sort of things off site. But also, if a building's halfway complete, it needs to be completed, and sometimes those subcontractors have the opportunity to renegotiate their contracts and get back in there. So it might be a bit short-sighted to go and spend a whole lot of money removing a whole lot of scaffolding, for example, and finding that you only just have to go and put it back again. So a bit of patience is important, and good communication to ensure that, you know, everyone is working together as much as possible. But there's an onus on the insolvency practitioner as well to make sure that they've got good communication, that they're responding to creditors' concerns, and answering the questions that they can. But there's also some information we just don't have on day one. It takes time to actually get to grips with, you know, what is the extent of the creditor claims that are there, and, you know, what assets can be realised and what can't.
Okay. Is there anything else that we've missed? What haven't we covered?
Oh, look, I mean, there's a whole range of things in insolvency that we cover a whole range of industries. We have an impact on a lot of people. It's a job where there's a huge amount of professionalism needed, and that's what Rattans is all about, is to hold high standards of professionalism in the industry, because at the end of the day, we're essentially trustees for creditors that have lost money, and so we could be holding millions of dollars on behalf of creditors that have lost a lot of money, and I think the important thing is to build trust in the profession, to make sure that we're doing the best that we can possibly do for the creditors, to get the maximum return that that the creditors are entitled to.
Yeah, and I think it's easiest, you know, someone who maybe is owed money to feel a bit of animosity towards those in your profession, because, you know, you get paid for what you do regardless, right? And yet there are others that have done a whole lot of work before you were involved who are wondering whether they're going to get paid anything or what sort of return they're going to get. And I guess that's it's not a nice position to be in.
No one likes losing money. That's for sure. And but no one would take the work on if they were at the end of the queue to get paid. But there is also times where we get appointed and there are no assets. We don't get paid. You know, there are jobs where we're writing off our fees as well.
Right.
And you know, I think Just because a company has lost money in the past, that shouldn't determine how the company is dealt with for the future. And that's where, you know, we have, you know, there's a lot of judgment, a lot of commercial judgment that needs to be made about what actions you take. So, you know, people, you know, will say, well, you know, you need to sue the directors, you know, you throw the kitchen sink at them. But if the directors haven't got any money, then it's a pretty pyrrhic victory. And, you know, and you end up costing the company more. So there's a, you know, there's a judgment that needs to be made with a fairly cool head. And, you know, and certainly when a business loses money and people are feeling very angry, it's not usually the best space to actually make some of those decisions.
Right. So when, you know, an organisation is facing the challenge that you know, an entity that owes the money has got into strife, what are the steps to go through? Is there information online where they can, you know, go and just find, you know, here's the basics around, you know, how you should put a claim in, you know, with the receiver, how you should you know, deal with assets that you have that are maybe sitting with the client, some of those common you know, common scenarios where they can just go through and get the black and white, and then, you know, if they need more help, then, you know, what's the best way? Do they go to the Rattan's website to get you know, pointed at the appropriate practitioners? What's the best way to go through that?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so I mean, receivers and liquidators have statutory obligations to, you know, notify the world at large that they've been appointed. So that, you know, in the public notices of the paper and the Gazette and that old fashioned sort of service, those sort of notices are put out.
Is there any electronic way that, you know,
the liquidator should
take a bit of time,
yeah,
for parties to get notified, you know, electronically, you know, email and so on.
Depends on the scale of the business. So,
right.
I mean, there's an obligation to write to all the creditors, all the known creditors. Now, the problem is sometimes if the company records are really poor, then it might take some time to be able to find all the creditors, and that's problematic. If it's a big enough company, then, you know, we'll put out a press release, and, you know, hopefully people know. And then, you know, we set up helplines and you know, website with information on the business. The liquidator and receiver also have to put out statutory reports, and you go onto the company's office website and find the company, and you will see the reports that are put up every 6 months on what's happened in the insolvency. So there is reporting requirements, but you're right. I mean, look, if you're uncertain, the best thing to do is pick up the phone and you know, if you go to the Rattan's website, there's a list of accredited insolvency practitioners, and they should be able to at least point people in the right direction.
Excellent. And it's worth noting that just about anybody can, you know, can get into this process. So there could be a big difference between somebody who's registered through Rattan's and other parties. Is that fair to say
at the moment that's the case? So you know, if you're over 18, if you're not bankrupt, if you haven't got a mental health order against you, you can be an insolvency practitioner, and that's why Rattan's was set up, because we say, well, that's way too loose, and in fact the insolvency practitioner bill is working its way through Parliament at the moment. It's got, I think, two stages to go before it's enacted, and we're expecting it will hopefully be enacted by the end of June this year. That will require all insolvency practitioners to be licensed, and a licensed insolvency practitioner will be subject to the rules of the likes of Chartered Accountants Australia and New Zealand. So there's minimum standards, there's a better complaints process if things aren't going well that creditors can call on. It's not as expensive as the process at the moment, which is essentially having to go to court if you're not happy with the way things have been dealt with.
Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you very much for your time, John Fisk.
Pleasure, Paul.
Cheers. I trust you enjoyed hearing from John Fisk. Coming up in the weeks ahead, we'll feature more insightful interviews, and of course, there is a back catalogue of chats with leaders such as Sir Graham Henry, Xero founder Rod Drury, Pushpay's Chris Heslop, Sir Michael Hill, and many more. If you'd like to find out more about my firm and sponsor, Guerrilla Technology, and how we help small to medium New Zealand organisations to use technology to increase productivity plus client and staff satisfaction, all whilst reducing cyber risks, then get in touch via www.guerrillatechnology.com. And if you'd like to try out the platform Guerrilla uses to capture business processes so anyone on your team can repeat them consistently, then go to nzbusinesspodcast.com/Process Street to sign up to trial Process Street and gain an ongoing lifetime discount, plus for a limited time, 1 hour free with a team member from Guerrilla who will help you tune your business operations with Process Street. All right, that's it from me. We'll catch you on the next episode of the New Zealand Business Podcast. And of course, if you want looking for more local podcasts to listen to, visit podcasts.nz. All right, see ya. The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.